Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Well, hello everyone. It's wonderful to be back in the studio with my two friends. And today we have a bit of a treat for you. We're doing a market update and it's exciting timing for us. We always get excited when the CoreLogic report comes out and the new financial year starts and we get some changes to government incentives and legislation. So without further ado, I want to welcome both of you, Dave and Pete. It's fun to be hosting. It's great to see you.
Lovely to see you two again.
Good to see both of you. We've got a lot to talk about.
We do. In fact, we're not even going to touch on our own market updates because we're doing a ginormous market update today. So, Dave, I'm going to throw the microphone over to you initially. When we look at the CoreLogic data, we've got all of our national and state breakdowns, including the regions. What are the big headlines for the national values and price movement?
There's a fair bit out. You know, we're at the end of the financial year and there's a lot to touch on. But if we start on maybe some of the key monthly numbers, What we can see is there's a clear trend that the rate of monthly acceleration in prices is reducing. It's still at high numbers though. So national growth was 1.9%, just under 2%. So, I mean, that's still annualized 24% growth per annum. So it's still very high.
Yes.
But particularly Perth and Darwin have really started to trail off now. So they're the only two capital cities with growth of less than 1%. Perth in particular is only 0.2% of growth. And other than Melbourne, it's been the poorest performed capital city over the last 12 months. Mm. Whereas Darwin, you know, you can understand it's had 21% capital growth over the last year. You know, if it didn't start to slow down, it'd be breaking all sorts of records for the growth rate. But I've been wondering why, you know, it's a bit of egg on Pete and my face because we've predicted Perth to be the best performance this calendar year. So there's still time for us, Pete.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking a little bit and interested in both your thoughts. Question without notice, but I feel like perhaps the stringent approach to shutting down the border is in Western Australia by Mark McGowan, the Premier, has meant that the Eastern Seaboard money has probably not sought holiday houses or refuge as much in Perth and Western Australia during COVID, because we know a lot of the price growth has come from that, particularly the regional price growth, and a lot of it has been people wanting to get further north and warmer weather as well. So I feel like that's probably part of what's held Perth back, and I still won't be surprised if we see outperformance as things start to open up. But I thought I'd see if either of you have thought about this conundrum.
I like your theory, Dave, and I think there's a plausibility there, but I would have the same argument for Anastasia Palaszczuk in Queensland, but look at Noosa and, you know, that's gone gangbusters. So there's not a correlation there. I tend to think that Perth's growth is always closely related to what's in the ground.
So, Kate, even though iron ore is at a record price, which you would think then property prices should be zooming ahead, in my own mind, I'm trying to work out if iron ore is going so well, then why isn't the Perth property market doing as well? I haven't found an answer yet, haven't worked it out.
Look, WA's definitely gone harder than Queensland though, Kate.
And, it has, you know, but for, Perth versus Noosa. Noosa has smashed Perth.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But that's sort of to my point.
Well, no, because it's not easy to get to Noosa. You know, border closure there is a genuine threat. We've got a premier up there that's pretty trigger happy with shutting the borders as well.
I think, though, WA's been more stringent on shutting the borders than Queensland.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
And so that's the only thing that I can come up with. That,
And it would, you know, it'd be interesting to keep monitoring that because so far as I can tell, despite the, you know, Australia-China trade dispute, they still need our iron ore. And you came up with some excellent material a few episodes ago, Dave, about how much of our iron ore they take, how top grade it is and so on. So that I can imagine that's going to continue, especially if they're going to be building infrastructure like the rest of the world to try and get their economies back on track. So to be, and you know, we could still be right, Dave. There might be a miracle and Perth might be the best performing capital city if it's on the back of iron ore prices, but geez, it's got to do really well in the last 6 months of the year.
We might be a year ahead of time.
As you both know, a lot can happen in 6 months.
Oh, yeah. Certainly.
Yeah. And I think we've got to remember too, these things are based on perception. So even though, let's say, McGowan has been incrementally worse than Palaszczuk, but not by a huge percentage in terms of how closely and quickly he's shut things down, there's still, you know, the perception of, look, I'm going to, yeah, go to, you know, or buy in Noosa versus, look, I don't know, it's the only thing I can come up with, but it seems to be quite a disparity. Doesn't it?
Yes.
Can you think of any other reason, Kate?
Why Perth hasn't kicked?
Yeah.
Possibly. You know, there's more land release in Perth. There's a lot of house and land. We've got to have a look at the incentives on offer there. And we're talking about median house prices here. Median doesn't necessarily reflect what we're always looking for in data, but that's a midpoint. You know, if there's a lot of affordable housing going, then that will adjust the median too. We actually need to look at sales volumes, days on market, increases in given areas. I think there's a lot more to drilling into the data than looking at a headline.
Definitely.
Which we should do. It's a good podcast question. Now there's
well, maybe we'll have a whole podcast on that.
Love it.
See if we can find deeper reason.
We could get some intel for some specialists. Now there's a bit of talk about the pace declining and that's consistent. It's not the first time I've seen economists and reports saying that the pace of growth is declining. It doesn't mean that we've got a declining market. It just means that we're not racing along at quite the same speed. What is your point on that particular finding, Dave?
In terms of why the rate is declining?
Yeah, and the various cities and how you'd apportion the rates of decline.
So Perth and Darwin, lowest. Hobart still flying. Canberra is also up there along with Sydney. One of the things to note is Hobart and Canberra stock levels dropped the most in the last month or so, so new listings.
Yeah.
So, you know, we know around winter people tend to have a perception it's not as good a greater time to sell, but the number of buyers tends to stay pretty similar, but the number of sellers can often drop. So I wonder how much of an impact that's having on Hobart and Canberra continuing to fly. That said, you know, they've been up there with the outperformers of the last 12 months. I also wonder about the smaller populations in terms of the impact on a macro higher level, you know, looking at medians solely. They're certainly still going gangbusters. Sydney is, yeah, right up there. Geography, it's a lot more limited in terms of its ability to spread and provide new plots of land. Melbourne, Brisbane and Adelaide are all sort of around that mid to high ones. Obviously, prices, the more prices grow, the less affordable they become.
Yes.
So they solve their own problem. And fixed rates are slightly increasing as well. Commonwealth Bank have just increased their assessment rates. I assume other lenders will follow to perhaps try and herd off APRA closing down any lending restrictions. That's, I guess, some of the high-level, very quick, superficial commentary. What are both of your thoughts?
I'm just having a look at the core data stuff here. And if we look at Sydney, so Sydney for the year has done 15%, but in the last quarter it's done 8%. So more than 50% of its growth has come in the last 3 months. So there's no slowdown there. Melbourne done 7.7% for the year, but 4.6% of that has come in the last 3 months. No slowdown there. Similar with Brisbane, Adelaide. The only one is Perth, which seems to be really slowing down, unfortunately for me and you, Dave. Our prediction's not looking so good. But for every other capital city, the latest 3 months is not indicating a slowdown.
overall, it's only an incremental slowdown.
Yes.
And it's actually part of what I touched on, maybe last month's one, but how the final sort of slow or negative months of the last 12-month period during the primary lockdown periods of COVID last year are starting to drop off the annual numbers. So even with this slight incremental, I mean, we're still averaging 2% growth, which annualised is 24%, and we're dropping off like negative months or low, you know, less than 1% months of last year. So even with smaller returns than we're getting at the moment, the annual figures are going to keep increasing. And that's where it's going to keep, if that makes sense.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It certainly does.
So, yeah, I think the next 6 months, the last 6 months of 2021 for property will be better than the last 6 months of 2020.
Mm.
So calendar year, yeah, I think 2021 is going to be quite remarkable, even better than financial year 20 to 2021.
Yeah.
Yeah, it started picking up around September, October.
Yeah.
Mm. It's going to be interesting to see how high national growth can hit.
I think we've still got elasticity between what people are prepared to or comfortable spending and what they can spend if they can get their hands on more. I know from, you know, polling the profile of buyers that I'm working with and understanding that clearly I'm dealing with a particular segment of buyers because they're the buyers that are prepared to pay for a professional service. So it's not necessarily indicative of the entire market. But what I am finding is there's a remarkable number, a huge percentage of our buyers that can go back and ask for more money if they want to. So I'm not necessarily dealing with people's rev limiters and they're not coming to me with their absolute maximum borrowing capacity. And I think if that's reflective of others in the market, we've still got price elasticity there.
Yeah, I think you're right. But if you look at CoreLogic's rolling three-month change in dwelling values across the broad valuation cohort, so that's the lower quartile, the middle market and the upper quartile, there's definitely a clear trajectory change of them coming down. And the upper quartile actually values decreased by the largest amount the first time in the last month, and normally they're a market leading indicator. So it does feel like that trend is, and there are peaks, you know, like historical highs. So, you know, it had to start slowing down, but a slowed down level is still a very high rate of growth.
I want to pick apart this data a little bit, and I do this every time, but where we're seeing that little peak dropping off fractionally, if we really question when this data would have come through, it would have been after the autumn, I won't use the word glut, but the autumn volume, which was a larger volume. What we know is in March, April, May, buyers per property were slightly less than right now. So if you're a buyer and you're in the market when the autumn listings came out in the capital cities, it would have been marginally easier. You would have had a little bit more luck buying a property. So if that's an indication of supply and demand and we're looking at the lag effect, that's a possibility. I'm not prepared to call it, you know, a market switch just yet because it's only just showing a slight tapering.
I agree. In my view, perhaps different to yours, I would say it's definitely clear that the market peak monthly increases has been hit.
Yep.
Whether it's a tapering that's pretty flat or whether it's actually a tapering that continues to sort of move downwards over 3 to 6 month period, you could say it's too early to say, but the last 2 to 3 months certainly are lower than that the peak month which we had, what was that, March, when it was the hit records since 2008?
Yeah.
Or yeah. So I think as a minimum we can be, it's tapered, but it's still, again, it's still growing strongly.
Yeah.
In pretty much everywhere except for Perth and Darwin, it would appear.
Yeah. Well, let's switch from the capital cities and have a little glance at the regions. I love the regions. Dave, quick overview on capitals versus regionals.
Basically, they're going neck and neck now by the looks of things. And both the last quarter, 6%. Capitals slightly ahead, 6.2%. But over the year, combined regions up 17.7%. which is fairly astonishing. And when you add on the yield, the rent, it's a 23% return over the last 12 months versus capitals of 15.9%. We're seeing a bit of a taper, but they're still holding pretty strong, aren't they?
Yeah, most definitely. And I've been fielding a few questions from journalists this week now that all of this data is out and about and they're wanting to, you know, string together some stories and explanations. It's been really fun to unpack it. But there's no doubt about it. We've got regions that haven't just been a flash in the pan as a result of COVID. We've got regions that were already on the move. They're more well known now. There's been an absolute acceptance of work from home or a hybrid arrangement. And I think we've got some regions that will continue to flourish.
Especially if they're within commuting distance of a capital city.
Yeah, I agree, Pete. Now, the interesting one for me, and I'm keeping a close eye on this one, is the annual change in rents. And we've got data that breaks down houses versus units. And for almost every capital city, it's looking pretty scary. I mean, we've got over 20% change in Darwin, which is just insane. And if you think about the plight of the renter, that's a very, very difficult rate of growth to overcome. And we really do have, in the main, a bit of an emerging rental crisis in our nation. And there's only a few exceptions, but even when we look at the exceptions, which is units in Sydney and Melbourne, they're on the improve. So I'd love to talk about that. Pete, what's your insight with the rentals data that's out?
So the rent increases have been huge. Darwin 24%, Perth 17%, Hobart 8%, Brisbane 6%, Canberra 8%. Adelaide 8%, Sydney 6%, Melbourne only 2% increase in the last year for houses. So I haven't looked at units, that's just houses. One of the main reasons, it's a bit like why property prices are going nuts, it's a shortage of supply. Yep. And so what's happening is typically out of 10 homes, 7 of them are rental properties. But now when those 10 homes are being bought, they're being bought by owner-occupiers. So there are 3 out of 10 less rental properties. You multiply that by 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, whatever it might be in a capital city, that's a significant number of rental properties that are now no longer available for tenants. You know, it's not uncommon, just like is happening at open inspections for properties for sale, at inspections for properties for rent, that there is a lineup. It is not uncommon for prospective tenants to offer more than the asking rent, because they understand that there's nowhere else to go. Even my own personal case, more of our tenants are just renewing and are willing to accept a higher rent to pay because they know they don't have many other alternatives. Not like you can go down the street and get a cheaper one because it's just not there. So for me, the story as to why rents are increasing so much is very similar to why property prices are increasing so much. That is, it's a shortage of supply.
Yeah, and it's a problem. It's a genuine problem, and mm-hmm. we've not got any measures in place to really attract our investors back other than low interest rates. And as soon as credit policy starts to bite, as soon as taxes are increased, as soon as rental management issues are created or things get a little bit more difficult for us to try and have people manage our property, it is a really difficult thing for people to think about doing if there's easier alternatives. So I think we've got a bit of a crisis looming, and we might have a government that has to really reevaluate how we get the help of mum and dad investors to help carry the housing load.
What are you thinking there, Kate? Or what would you do, or what's on your mind regarding that? And what's driving that thinking?
Well, if we've got national rents flying at this kind of level, what it really means is for the most vulnerable, they're going to find it very, very difficult to get a roof over their head, and it's going to put more pressure on us as a society to consider the social impact of that. And there's no way that our government, state or federal, can house everyone that needs help or can subsidise it. It's not in the budget. We can't do that. So we've had this scenario for many years, and it's why we have negative gearing and other incentives to bring mum and dad investors into the market to help share that load. And negative gearing is one incentive, but we've got a few things that are pushing investors away. And namely, the last 5 years has been credit policy. That's been very difficult. And there was a distinct move there to slow down investment activity because it was perceived that investors were taking away opportunities from first home buyers. And there are ways to manage that. But at the moment, we've got hefty taxes, we've got land tax issues, we've got a different rate of stamp duty for investors versus owner occupiers in some of our states. We're not really rolling out the welcome mat to investors and saying, come on board. And in true fashion, our government will realise after the crisis has become a real issue that they need to do something about it. And they'll probably pivot and overreach it again, and then we'll just jump back on the merry-go-round and have more of a cycle. But I think we need to reevaluate tax. I think that is a common one. We can't reevaluate our tenancy laws because they've been rolled out in many states and as difficult and as unmanageable as we think some of them are, I don't see that particular set of changes being pivoted. But I think that tax might be something that they put a spotlight on if it becomes a real issue.
And I think the other thing that we can look at, Dave, and I'd like your input, is the availability of finance to investors. Because, Kate, you hit the nail on the head. It was actually in 2017 when there were extra restrictions put on investor loans that we actually saw nationally, we saw the vacancy rates start to drop. And vacancy rates, there will be a time when vacancy rates drop where rents will go up. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. So, Dave, we had investors had to pay a higher interest rate than owner occupiers, correct?
Yeah, so that started. So I'm just looking at some of the stats here. So we are back on the increase, okay? So 5 of the last 6 months, investors have increasing at a faster rate than owner-occupier activity. So
because first-time buyer incentives have disappeared now.
Yeah, and investors are starting to get the courage to go, okay, the market is going to keep moving, we don't want to miss out, and we've gotten through COVID, and so they're buying property again. So, look, I think it's headed in the trajectory to create more stock for it to become more affordable for those who don't own a property. Whether that stops it on its own over time or not, but yeah, it certainly once APRA started putting the restrictions on, I'm just trying to look because the numbers, I've got a number here, but it was something like, you know, 45% of all loans were to investors, and it's dropped as low as like 15% or some number like that.
So, drop. And yeah. Wasn't the other thing, Dave, APRA restricted how much banks could lend to investors? When I say how much, the proportion of their loans, like it was only 10% of their loans to go to investors?
Yeah, so the number of interest-only loans was capped, but also the amount your book of lending to investors could grow by. It couldn't grow by greater than 10%. Yeah. Plus the rates were higher, therefore the assessment rates were higher. They also, a big one was they forced the banks to change how you assess someone's borrowing capacity. So it used to be, you know, like one bank, you could organise 15-year interest-only loans, which we would do because it gave people the greatest flexibility, and they were still determined their borrowing capacity over a 30-year loan term. Nowadays, you have to take off the interest-only period and work out whether they can repay it over the remaining term. So that seriously restricts borrowing capacity. So anyone, forget about the rates being higher and the assessment rate higher, having that change on how you assess interest-only loans to only be over the remaining period of the loan post the interest-only period, that had the biggest negative impact on borrowing capacity for investors.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's still the case.
And multi-property investors, as you said, Dave, when they upped the ante with the servicing rates, it wasn't just for the loan you're going for. So back in the good old days, if we're looking at financing someone who was going for an investment property, you might have a higher buffer rate on the purchase, but you could use actual for all of their other existing debt. Now, as soon as you're talking about multiple debts and you're adding servicing buffers to all of them, we were often seeing that the clients who might have been able to borrow X dollars 2 years ago were suddenly not even technically demonstrating on the calculator that they could service the debt that they already had. And that was very common. Yeah.
Yeah, that became very common. And it's why one of the reasons the second tier lenders are getting a fair bit of business still is the borrowing capacity still has those flexibilities because they're non-banks, and so they don't have to follow these restrictions that APRA place on the banks. And it certainly applies to multi-property owners much more often.
We could go down this rabbit hole and we get pretty excited, but I want to keep quizzing you on this CoreLogic report.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website,
which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Dave, let's chat about resales, pain and gain. It's a really telling snapshot of a key issue in our market right now.
Resales, we are at a record highs, I believe, in terms of the percentage of properties that are being sold for a profit. That is up above 90%. So 9 out of every 10 properties that are being resold are being sold for a profit. The COVID-induced low, it got down to 86% in the 3 months to June 2020, so after the initial lockdown occurred. And to some of Pete's commentary earlier on, you know, in the March quarter, there's a big discrepancy between units and houses. Units, 16.8% of units sold for a loss, but only 6.8% of houses.
That's a very good point you make there, Dave, because I was having a look at the most recent CoreLogic data, and this is just going on 1 year. So in Sydney, like we talked about in general, it went up 15%, but when you break it down into houses and units, houses have improved by 19.3%, but units only 5%, significantly lower. Yep. Melbourne, even though houses have only gone up by 8.9%, units 4.7%. And the story is consistent for every capital city except for Darwin, where where we're looking at just a very slight difference in capital growth. But that's only 1 year. But what I did is I pulled out the research that I did a few years ago back on. So the book that I wrote, Top Australian Suburbs, I looked at 107 suburbs across Australia and in 2008. But in 2018, I went back to see how well or how poorly I did so far as my forecasting was concerned. But the thing I want to point out here is in Melbourne. So I picked 20 suburbs in Melbourne, and over that 10-year period, houses outperform units in every single suburb. Now, just to give you an idea that I didn't pick, you know, really daggy suburbs, the suburbs included Geelong, Abbotsford, Braybrook, Brunswick, Brunswick East, Carron, Chelsea, Coburg, Collingwood, Cremorne, Flemington, Footscray, Frankston, Kingston, Maidstone, Mortialik, Seaford, West Footscray, Yarraville. Some pretty good suburbs, some up-and-coming suburbs, some gentrifying suburbs. In 20 out of 20, houses did better than units. If I look at the Sydney data, there was only one suburb where units performed marginally better than houses over that 10-year period. So 19 out of those 20 suburbs, which include Arncliffe, Ashfield, Baxia, Bexley, Camperdown, Campsie, Chippendale, Darlington, Enmore, Erskineville, Forest Lodge. Sounds like a song here, doesn't
what's
it?
What's that song? I've been everywhere, man.
And lots of other up-and-coming suburbs. Again, over a 10-year period, it shows that houses perform better than units. And we've talked about that many times on many different episodes. If you're looking for capital growth, it's that land-to-asset ratio. You need to have a property with a significant land component.
Which you can get in established units when there's less units in the block, on a big block. Just to be clear for the listeners, it's not all units are poor investments, but generally speaking, the newer ones have much lower land-to-asset ratios because you've got hundreds of units on a smaller parcel as land as possible that the developer can fit them on.
And look, there are two other currents that we're fighting against with units, in particular with apartments. And that is, first and foremost, COVID has reshaped what we want and what we think our minimum criteria is. And that's always a tough blow. And secondly, if it's brand new, there will be a marketers and developers and builders premium built in there. You can't just blindly buy something off a product spec sheet and a price list and assume that you're getting a sharp deal. There has to be profit in there. And of course, that will take the price tag most likely over market value. So if you're already buying over market and then potentially selling down the track, well, you'll have a greater chance of incurring a loss, unfortunately.
And where this is most amplified, and this is to a point you raised in an episode not too long ago, Kate, where a friend buyer's agent, I think in Queensland, asked a question about what was happening with the Melbourne vacancy rates. Mm. So if we have a look, Sydney and Melbourne have higher vacancy rates generally than most of the other capital cities, But that's because their CBD vacancy rates are so high.
Yeah.
So the Sydney CBD vacancy rate was 6.8% in May, 7.3% in April, versus the overall market of around 3%. And Melbourne's entire market is down at 3.7% in May, but it's 8% in the CBD. Okay, and so this is that story. And, yeah, certainly often we're talking high-level macro numbers, but there's stories, numbers within numbers, and that's, I guess, an example of why units are underperforming dwellings, and to the point of the low land-to-asset ratios, the resale. You know, it's coming out in the stats if you dig a bit deeper. But we've only got 30 minutes in these episodes.
And I think we're already over that time today.
Yeah, we've got 8 minutes to go until we say cheerio. So I'm just thinking, we do have a lot of data that we would have loved to unpack, and I'm going to keep it moving. Dave, what's another highlight that you'd like to share? Because we've got pages here.
What struck you with the listing activity, Kate?
Oh, it's pretty grim.
From a buyer's agent perspective.
Yeah, it's tough, and it's contributing to our imbalance of buyers and sellers. And, of course, that puts pressure on prices because you've got more people wanting one property. My ratio is number of buyers per property. I can get to an auction. If it's good property, how many people will put their hands up? Now, I've got one that I'm attending tomorrow. They've got 9 registered buyers.
Already.
Do you know, look, a message I'd like to get to our listeners who are trying to make better property decisions through the help of our podcast, consider selling in winter. This is just perfect example. Listings are much lower. It's much harder to buy quality property. More people competing for the same property, okay? It seems as though this has been a message that's been shared for a number of years by property professionals, but it still hasn't sort of got mass market awareness, has it? Because the number of listings in spring are still so much higher than winter.
Yeah, it's a really good point to make, Dave. And unfortunately, particularly in the colder months, we really struggle to get vendors to see that because people like social proof. They like selling when everyone else is. They like it when the sun's out and the garden's looking its best. They don't really like to contend with mud through the house. There's a lot of reasons why people are a bit more reluctant, but it absolutely is a great time to consider selling.
So every capital city over the month of June, except for Darwin, probably no surprises, climate-based, about as warm during winter. It has as many people selling properties as the rest of the year generally, but Canberra and Hobart, as I touched on before, have had the biggest drop in listings, two of the coldest places to be in Australia in winter. Again, it's climactic reasons that are driving these decisions, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
As opposed to rational market-based decisions. Again, that probably helps to drive some of the results that are coming through in terms of the property market maintaining its strong returns, month-on-month returns, just slight dips. Yeah. Pete, did you want to add anything else there with the listings?
I said before that the main reason property rents and property prices are increasing is because of a lack of supply, which means a lack of properties for sale or a lack of listings. But that's not the whole case. If I could just point out, Darwin has been the best performing capital city so far as property price increases are concerned over the last 12 months. At 21%, right? And then we have Hobart, the second best performing capital city, if I use round numbers, 20%. So they're very similar. But when we look at supply, Hobart has 38% less houses for sale today than it did a year ago, but Darwin has 2% more houses for sale today than it did a year ago. So there's obviously something else other than supply that is driving the market. And obviously the other one is
actually,
demand.
Just jump in there though, Pete, but interestingly, Darwin has just started to fall off in terms of its growth. Maybe there actually is a reasonable correlator now that's starting to play through.
That's a good point that you make, because those listings would be based on what there is today.
Mm.
And if they've started to slow, it would be interesting to get that, say, the data from 3 months ago and see what was happening then.
Have a look at the trend.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
And, Pete, you mentioned, you know, there's more forces than just supply and demand, and there absolutely is. We've got really cheap interest rates and we've got sentiment at a really high level. And we've also got a lot of people getting a bit nervous about the share market and looking to diversify. So we've got a perfect storm at the moment.
We have. We've actually having a, I wouldn't say a heated debate, but a, certainly a very interesting discussion with one of the professors at work who said that he felt that interest rates were the biggest driver of property prices. And I said to him, I think that used to be the case, but I think now what's the two most important influences for me are consumer confidence and the availability for finance. Mm. It almost doesn't matter what level interest rates are. If people can't borrow the money, even if interest rates were at 1.1% where they are now, if the banks put so many hurdles in place that they couldn't borrow the money, it's not going to increase the uptake of loans, which will then increase the demand for property.
Yeah, really good point, Pete.
You could say there's an interconnection between, like, low interest rates probably would make people more confident.
I think it,
and
I think
it makes it easy to borrow money as well.
Yeah. I think the big turnaround for this boom will be when interest rates start to increase. Before, it used to be, in my opinion, interest rates were the biggest influencer of property prices. Mm. But since the last boom back in 2001, 2 and 3, that was not the case. That changed.
Do you know, it would be interesting to do. The cities that have had the strongest growth are certainly, there's a connection to smaller populations at the moment anyway. So Hobart, mm-hmm. Darwin, Canberra of the capital cities, which feeds into the regionals outperforming.
Correct.
The bigger capital
yeah.
cities as well. So there's COVID's playing a big, big part broadly, and you'd think more and more as life gets back to normal, that is going to, that correlation to COVID is going to reduce. And that's why I also think Melbourne will have a longer run up, because it's a fair way behind the other capital cities. So coming out of it, I think it'll go for longer.
Is that a bet, Dave?
Yeah, that's a bet. Who wants the bet?
Well, I reckon that the same show that I said Perth was going to be great, I reckon I said Melbourne was going to be one of the bottom performers. Mm. I think. Yeah.
Well, Kate doesn't get off the hook. She said Melbourne would be the best.
Yeah, I said it'd do all right. And speaking of bets, I don't think we've updated our listeners, just a little side bet, on the results of your auction, Pete, or did we?
Oh,
yeah.
I don't think we
did. Because Dave and I
right.
went big time. We thought it would be $9.40, $9.50 because we were conditioned from the last one flying.
Yeah.
And it turns out it fell right between your $10,000 gap, which made you look like an absolute valuations genius.
That was just pure luck. But for those people that did that homework that I set a few episodes ago, that property in Brooklyn Park sold for $8.45. And if you're not sure why it sold for that, I've got some comparable sales there and some explanations as to why I think it would sell for that. So if you want to follow up on that, please do. We've got some very comprehensive notes there, and I always love to use real-life examples, whether it's the podcast or in my classes, and that'll give you a better understanding as to how to value like an expert.
Yeah. Now, I'm not letting you...
delete the episode where you missed out by a long way, Pete.
we've rubbed his nose in it.
The recording's missing.
We'll get rid of that from...
At the end of this podcast, we'll say, to follow up on that one that Pete stuffed up, check out episode... Now, before I let you off the hook, we're about to run over, but it's worth it. Monetary policy and the RBA minutes, Dave, can I ask you to touch on that?
Yeah, I'll try and give it a brief summary. So they basically said they're going to keep retaining the April 2024 bond as the bond yield target, which with a target of 10 basis points. So they have reduced the purchasing of government bonds, reduced that down from $5 billion a week to $4 billion a week. So that's a slight tapering off of monetary policy. They've basically said high level that they plan to lag the other central banks in lifting rates, and that the move on rates is still unlikely to happen till 2024, although a lot of markets or economists are starting to predict end of 22 into 2023. But they're saying, look, we're going to wait till if inflation's in our target band. Our inflation and our wage growth is lower than most of the other first world countries and the OECD nations, And so they, I think they're able to sort of sit back and watch. And the Aussie dollar's actually, they're trying to keep that under control. It's dropped back for those who haven't noticed during the week. It's come down from about 77, 78 cents down to 75 cents. So that's something they're very pleased about. So look, overall, they're basically saying until, again, till inflation and wage outcomes occur to the level that they're looking for, they're not going to move rates up, and they're holding their nerve on that. So we're more likely to see macroprudential APRA stepping in to slow down lending, to therefore slow down the property market, than the RBA increasing rates in the short to medium term.
I agree with you. We've got to remember that the property market is one segment of our economy. You know, they're not sitting there gauging the property market and nothing else. It's not how they roll. So I absolutely agree with you, Dave. And I think the whispers of it and the efforts that we've already seen from one key lender, I think we'll see a little bit more of that.
Hey, just before we go to our gold nuggets, could I give a big pat on the back to our expert co-host, Dave Johnson, because he's nailed something on the head here. You know, Dave, we were talking about why there was such a large discrepancy between the total listings of Darwin and Hobart. Even though their property price increases were very similar, the total number of listings were at extreme ends, right? So in this other chart that you've provided, I can see the month in the last 30 days, the change in listings in Hobart is 12%, 12% more, all right, which is the best performing one. You know what it is in Darwin? 180% more.
Wow.
So all of those listings have come on in the last month. So it's not truly reflective of a long period of time.
Nate, I was wondering what you were doing. I could see you reading away in the corner there.
Well, even though I'm a man, I can do two things at once.
Thanks for that, Pete.
That is phenomenal. 180% extra.
It is huge. And
I think it's a great example. You know, it's a live example. We just noticed it as we were talking, but where you look at enough data sets, you can start to see interconnections that are driving what's occurring. And, you know, you discuss it, you look at it, you consider it, and you can start to see the patterns and what's causing what. Sometimes in these episodes too, we're just hypothesising and hoping we might be getting some things right.
Speak for yourself. Well, on that note, we have truly had a smashing time record here. You've got something that you want to talk about, and I'm going to propose we bounce it forward to be its own episode, and that is the concept of right-sizing, not downsizing, but right-sizing. I think there's a lot of gold in that, so we'll let our listeners stay tuned. But on that note, put your thinking...
It's a baby boomer story.
It is, and we can talk about boomers and all kinds of drivers and influences there. But until then, have you got your gold nuggets ready?
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
My gold nugget is when you're looking at explanations why things might be happening in the property market or wherever it might be, you need to look deep down into the stats. Don't just look at the headlines of a news story or even read the article. Have a look at the stats that the article quotes and do your own research, because often the answers can be found in that deep dive, not just in that headline.
I really want to dig into the Darwin information now. What's driving those huge listings? Is it just the fact prices have gone up by 20% and people have been holding underperforming properties, because we know that market's been really dropped over the last 10 years? Anyway,
it just
opens up more questions.
Yeah, is it a row of massive developments and, you know, developers flogging 1,000 units? And it, what could it be?
Yeah.
We'll find out.
So we'll find out. All right. So my gold nugget is that investor loans equated to 28% of the total value of housing loan commitments in May this year, but they're at 46%. In 2015, which is the last time APRA put in place measures to cool down the market. So still significantly lower than the last time APRA stepped into the market. So it signals there's potentially a way to go if they want to keep ensuring there's a good supply of rental properties for people to live in, and that rental properties don't become too expensive for those who are yet to purchase a house for themselves.
On that note, it's been really fun catching up, and we've only scratched the surface with this. I reckon we got through 50% of our updates, but that's how it rolls when we get excited. So look after yourselves, and I look forward to seeing you next week, and we'll have a surprise in store for our listeners.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to know more about planning for your next property decision, take a listen to episode number 4, How to Develop Your Property Plan. Start with the end in mind. Episode number 6, What Determines Your Property Strategy. Episode number 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. And episode number 22, Why the Family Home is Often the Biggest Piece of the Investment Puzzle.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.